Studio 360.
John Green has the singular distinction of being a YouTube superstar as well as a bona fide literary superstar. On YouTube, with his little brother Hank, he creates and hosts a whole bunch of educational shows for young people. Their YouTube channel has got more than 20 million subscribers.
Good morning, Hank. It's Tuesday. It's Question Tuesday, the day that I answer real questions from real nerd fighters. Let's get right to it.
And John Green is also one of the big-time YA novelists. His novels are written for teenagers, but they're nuanced and complicated and sometimes unsettling in great ways. And they have sold in the tens of millions of copies. Some of them have been adapted into movies, most famously, The Fault in Our Stars.
All right. What's your story?
I already told you. I was diagnosed when I was 13.
No, not your cancer story, your real story. Your interests, your hobbies, your passions, your weird fetishes.
Weird fetishes?
Come on, just think of something. The first thing that pops in your head, something you love.
He's got a new novel called Turtles All the Way Down. It is a story told by a teenage girl named Aza, who's got both a great and vivid imagination and extreme anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder. John Green's here to talk about the new book, his online celebrityhood, and some of the cultural works that shaped him. John, welcome to Studio 360.
No, it's great to be here.
You started writing mainly about teenagers in your fiction, and you still do. No doubt you've explained 1,000 gazillion times why that's true, but why did you and why do you?
I like writing about teenagers because they're doing so many things for the first time, and there's something intense about that, and there's also something that lacks any kind of irony about that, and I find it really, really appealing. Like, they're falling in love for the first time. A lot of times they're grappling with grief for the first time, but they're also asking, like, those big questions of being a person for the first time about meaning and suffering and whether meaning is inherent to human life or something that we have to construct together, and I love those questions, and I love the way that teenagers look at them, and I think that's really the attraction for me about teen characters.
Does it ever worry you that as you now are 40, and someday will be 50 and beyond, that like
hopefully
it like holds you back?
I do worry that, you know, as I get older, I become someone who knows less and less about teen culture. But then when I was a teenager, I knew almost nothing about teen culture. Yeah. So I don't know how much of a concern that is. I think a lot of the emotional experiences are universal.
Right. The Fault in Our Stars was narrated by a girl. This new one, Turtles All the Way Down, narrated by a girl. Having written a novel in the voice of a woman, I know that that's a daunting thing. Why do you keep doing that?
Well, I definitely felt a responsibility to, to try to get it right. Aza and I are different in a lot of ways. That's one of the really important ways, but there are other really important ways that we're different. And I think writing is always an act of empathy. It's always an attempt to get outside of oneself. That's one of the things I like about it. Myself can feel like a dangerous and scary place to be stuck inside of. And I think one of the things that I've liked about writing since I was a kid is the feeling that I can almost be magically transported out of my consciousness and into someone else's when it's working. I'd been working on a different novel for almost a year, and I was 40,000 words into it, and it was frustrating, and it wasn't working. And then one afternoon, I opened up a Gmail window to start sending an email, and instead of sending that email, I started to write about these two kids, Aza and Daisy, and that's just how they showed up.
And this book for teenagers gets metafictional. Whoa, it's a girl who thinks she's a fictional character who understands other human beings in this book as fictional characters, but they're real, but they're fiction, you know. But in this case, I mean, it isn't ultimately this metafictional conceit because it is a symptom of her mental disorder, right?
Right. I mean, she is worried that she's not really real, not because she's worried that she might be a character in a novel written by
yes.
me, but because she's worried that essentially her fate is being written by the microbes that colonize her gut and then secondarily by the fear that those microbes cause her.
Right. I mean, it's arguable, and I believe true, that who we are is the result of bits of matter in our brains doing what they're doing as opposed to bits of matter in our gut. So she's nutty, but it's half true.
Well, I think a lot of people who struggle with, or at least I guess I can only speak to my own experience. In my experience with obsessiveness is that it begins in a place that reason can't effectively touch. It has to be true enough that I can't close the loop through logic. And that's part of what I find difficult about my obsessive thought spirals is that I can't get out of them via more thinking.
Right. I was impressed by the passages where you are depicting this mental state. That must have been a kind of literary technical challenge to figure out how far to go and how confused and disorganized to make that prose.
Yeah. I mean, one of the great challenges of writing about pain, I think especially physical pain, but also psychic pain, is that it doesn't lend itself well to language. It resists direct description, right? You can't talk about abstract feelings of psychic pain the way you can talk about a table or chairs. And so you have to try to find language for it. You have to try to find some kind of form or expression for it. But in that process, a lot of times you end up with these metaphors. And metaphors can feel exaggerated and they can feel distancing. And one of the great frustrations that I've found is that I find this pain extremely isolating at times because I can't share it and because it's so hard to find language for it. And so that was, I guess, really the central problem I wanted to look at in the book. You know, was there a way that I could give some kind of expression to this experience in a way that would make other people be able to glimpse it?
No, and you've done that. Does it feel cathartic in that sense?
It doesn't feel cathartic. I would have liked that narrative. I would have liked to be able to tell you that I thought it made me better, that writing the story was deeply healing. But I emerged from it with the same problem that I had when I started it. It wasn't a cure or anything.
Yeah.
Because I was writing about someone who wasn't me, I was able to feel a lot of sympathy toward Aza and a lot of compassion toward her that, frankly, at times I've struggled to feel toward myself. And there was definitely a lesson in that for me.
So when you were writing Turtles All the Way Down, or deciding to write it, you were, as I've read, coming off a horrible kind of, is it fair to call it a relapse of your lifelong OCD experiences?
Yeah. I had a really bad period of mental health in the fall of 2015, during which, for months, I wasn't able to choose any of my thoughts, which was tremendously destabilizing for my sense of self because, you know, if you can't choose what you're thinking about, then A, you know, who exactly is running the ship, and B, whose thoughts are these?
Yes, yes.
Unfortunately, I think in my case, it was a pretty clear cause, which is that I bought into this extremely dangerous but pervasive romantic lie that going off my medication would somehow make me more creative and would end the period of writer's block that I'd had, and that the consequences of that were, as they often are for people, catastrophic. So I think it was very clearly caused by that. Uh-huh. And then it was just extremely difficult to get back to a place where my health problem was able to be treated somewhat effectively. And that did finally happen after several months. But, you know, from inside of those months, they felt like they were going to last forever.
And you came out of it and felt in balance again. And then you said, well, I actually have to go there in my fiction now and create a character who has this problem.
I think it was really difficult for me to write about anything else. I tried to go back to the story that I had been writing, but it was the thing that I needed to write about. You know, you remember how scary that was and how painful it was. And, you know, you're scared that it could come back at any time. And so I think it was hard for me to even imagine writing about a kid who had anything other than this thing, you know, that I'd had in high school and that I remembered having in high school and that I'd also just come out of this really, really difficult experience with.
Yeah. Given that most of your readers are adolescents, does that change the nature of what you feel your responsibility is beyond creating a great story and great characters?
I do feel a responsibility to try to tell the truth, and I believe that, for lack of a better way of saying this, that the truth is hopeful. I believe that hope is the correct response to the world.
Uh-huh.
And so I do feel a responsibility to be hopeful, but only in the sense that I feel a responsibility to be honest.
But if you were writing books for adults, would you feel the same responsibility to be hopeful because that's your take on how we should be human?
I would, yeah. I would feel the same way. I would feel the same set of responsibilities, I think. It's hard to know for sure, but I think I would.
Yeah.
I mean, in general, I think that teenagers are tremendously intelligent and thoughtful readers. And one of the cool things about having teenagers read your books is that, you know, in any given year, most of the people reading Hamlet in America are teenagers, you know?
That's funny. I mean, yes, yes. Well, and now that you're being assigned in high school curricula, does that change the nature of how you feel about the audience you're writing for?
It is very weird to me that that has happened. For the record, I think high school kids should read Toni Morrison. I guess my response to it is that inevitably when you read a book in a high school English class, you read it differently, right? Like, I remember reading The Great Gatsby in my high school English class and announcing that it was a terrible novel, a complete failure in every possible way. And, that, of course, was not the fault of The Great Gatsby.
You were wrong, John, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Right. That was the fault of me as a reader. I think the way we approach stuff that we read in English classes, or at least the way I did in high school, is vastly different from the way we approach pleasure reading.
Exactly.
But I don't think differently about the writing process.
Right, right. Yes. Your first novel, a dozen years ago, Looking for Alaska, has been banned by some because of, most spectacularly, I guess, because of this scene involving oral sex between a couple of teenagers in that book. None of your books are G-rated particularly, but why do you think that particular scene in that particular novel causes so much discomfort among grown-ups?
I think because we are a lot more obsessed over sex than we are about violence or drug use or profanity or whatever else people might use as a reason to ban a book from a high school classroom. But that scene is very graphic, intentionally very graphic. In context, I think it reads very differently than, you know, a lot of times when this stuff happens, people photocopy two pages from a book, they send it to the principal and they say, as you can see, these two pages are filthy. But then if you read the scene in context, the meaning of it completely changes. And that's why, we shouldn't pick which books to share in schools or which books not to based on, you know, two decontextualized pages.
Right. So you have these little kids. In 5 or 10 years, they're going to be teenagers. At what point do they get to read dad's novels?
I'm hoping that my children will be as uninterested in my work as I was in my parents' work.
I think you can bet on that. So we have talked a lot about this new book. Could you read a bit from it? Maybe the very beginning?
Sure.
Great.
At the time I first realized I might be fictional, my weekdays were spent at a publicly funded institution on the north side of Indianapolis called White River High School, where I was required to eat lunch at a particular time, between 12:37 and 1:14 p.m., by forces so much larger than myself that I couldn't even begin to identify them. If those forces had given me a different lunch period, or if the table mates who helped author my fate had chosen a different topic of conversation that September day, I would have met a different end, or at least a different middle. But I was beginning to learn that your life is a story told about you, not one that you tell. Of course, you pretend to be the author. You have to. You think, I now choose to go to lunch when that monotone beep rings from on high at 12:37. But really, the bell decides. You think you're the painter, but you're the canvas.
I love that line, you think you're the painter, but you're the canvas, even though I think one is actually both. painter and canvas. So we asked you for some of the things that have been big influences on you. And one of them you told us about is Harvey, the play and the great Jimmy Stewart movie where he's got this giant rabbit as his imaginary friend. Here's a clip from the film.
Oh, doctor, years ago, my mother used to say to me, she'd say, in this world, Elwood, you must be, she always called me Elwood. In this world, Elwood, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. Well, for years I was smart. I recommend pleasant. You may quote me.
Now, of course, he in that movie, I guess you could say, has a mental illness because he believes he's talking to this giant rabbit. What did you love about that movie? How was it helpful to you?
It was normalizing. I think that was one of the reasons it was helpful to me. It also just came to me in the right moment, at a moment when I desperately needed somebody to normalize behavior that the world felt was...
weird.
Was so weird that it couldn't talk about, or it was so shameful that it shouldn't be the subject of movies.
When was that moment?
Oh, I was really sick. That was one of the sickest periods of my life. I'd actually just left my job. I took a leave of absence from my job working at Booklist Magazine. And on my way out the door, my boss said, now more than ever, watch Harvey. And I don't believe in epiphanies or anything like that, but I do know that I have never felt as bad since I watched Harvey as I felt before I watched Harvey. Huh. There are a lot of reasons for that, but that movie, it's so big-hearted, and it welcomes, in the end, this guy Elwood into the pantheon of American movie heroes. And that felt so great. So there's that. And then there's also just that it is a very funny, very wise movie. I mean, that line is one of the great lines in American movies. Like, how deeply true is that? Like, you can be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. And I share Elwood's belief that pleasant is the better path in the end.
I was watching videos of you and your brother. And you both have a kind of Jimmy Stewart affect.
Well, that's kind of you to say. It's been this amazing project for the last 11 years of going from not being particularly close to my brother to having him be my closest collaborator and somebody I turn to literally every day to talk about the stuff that matters to us. And it's wonderful.
Another one of your influences, I guess. The Mountain Goats, the excellent John Darnielle's band. I want to play one of your favorite Mountain Goat songs and one I like as well.
The best ever death metal band out of Denton. Never settled on a name. But the top three contenders, after weeks of debate, were Satan's Fingers and the Killers and the Hospital Bombers.
That's Best Ever Death Metal Band out of Denton from 2002 by the Mountain Goats. What did you fall in love with there?
I mean, with that song in particular, it's just it's a hymn. It's a hymn to every kid who feels like an outcast and the way the social order can make that so much worse.
Mm-hmm.
I love the Mountain Goats because they make songs that feel like they're for me. And there's also... something that harkens back to childhood experience and sort of by acknowledging it somehow helps heal it. And that's one of the things I've always loved about that song.
Another favorite thing we share is the movie Rushmore, which was Wes Anderson's breakout movie starring Jason Schwartzman as this nerd delinquent at prep school, Rushmore Academy, and Bill Murray as his unlikely pal. And here's a clip from that film.
What's the secret, Max?
The secret?
Yeah, well, you seem to have it pretty figured out.
Secret, I don't know. I think you just gotta find something you love to do and then do it for the rest of your life. For me, it's going to Rushmore.
That's
such a great line.
Yes. That is Jason Schwartzman and Bill Murray in Wes Anderson's Rushmore, 1998. What did you love about that movie?
I mean, I went to a boarding school. I was a terrible student at that boarding school. I have a lot in common with a lot of characters in that movie, but especially Max. And I love that movie for its lines, for the way it talks about the creative process, and then just its aesthetic is amazing. I mean, just the visual life of that movie is such a pleasure to spend time with.
And is Max's secret, find what you love and do it for the rest of your life? Is that pretty much the John Green secret as well?
I mean, I think it's a great life strategy. But I mean, to be honest, if I was going to find what I love and do it for the rest of my life, I'd probably spend my days listening to the mountain goats fishing on the White River. So I haven't chosen exactly that path.
Right, right. John Green's Turtles All the Way Down is out now and available everywhere. Thank you, sir. That was great.
That was really fun. Thank you.